This week saw President Obama being handed a stunning defeat by his usual allies, a higher-profile campaign launch from Hillary Clinton, and mounting expectation of a Jeb Bush announcement today. Hello, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Welcome to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kathleen Dunn will be back tomorrow. For today's All Things Political, we visit with Carl Cannon, Washington Bureau Chief for Real Clear Politics. Carl, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Judith.
Well, it was certainly a big week, and there's a lot to dig into. But the thing that I just found fascinating was what happened for President Obama with Congress on Friday. He was counting on the Trans-Pacific Partnership to be one of the legacies of his presidency. Before we get into what happened on Friday to impact that, can you explain the Trans-Pacific Partnership for us?
Well, this is the lowering trade barriers. It's sort of, think about NAFTA, but instead of Mexico or Canada, it's the Pacific Rim, which is by far the largest trading partner, you know, the Pacific countries with the United States, you know, three or four times as much as Europe. And this would give the president authority to negotiate what were called fast track agreements. This is the way Congress has decided these trade agreements go. The out party complains about it, but they usually give him the authority. But the Democrats didn't, and a majority of Republicans did, and a majority of Democrats didn't, and that's where we are. And it was, you saw these things that you were talking about. The president really made these extraordinary appeals, but in the end, he couldn't persuade his party to join him.
Well, and he said that this agreement, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, is really crucial to counter Chinese influence and expansion. Is it that important?
I'm not a trade expert, but. You know, I'm a free trader. These things tend to work. Labor has objections to them. The central objection is that it makes it too easy for American firms to locate overseas because you've got these favorable trading agreements, and that it costs American jobs. The Republicans, who have become really over the last 30 years a really free trade party, despite what you may hear from Rand Paul or a few outliers, Republicans' only hesitation was giving the authority to Barack Obama. But in the end, their leaders convinced them, well, you know, you're giving it to the president. We've always given it to the president. And hopefully in 2 years we'll have a Republican there, so it's okay. But, you know, look, the president wants this, and the president thinks it's good for the economy. And he really couldn't seal the deal within his party.
And this has been a decade in the making. Why is this the point where it's coming to a head?
Judith, that's an interesting thing, and the politics of it. You know, I don't know how many of our listeners read Maureen Dowd's column on Sunday in the New York Times, but she thinks what's coming home to the chickens. She had a funny phrase: the lame duck's chickens are coming home to roost. That the President Obama has not shared the credit with Democrats. His idea of negotiating with Republicans is to go out in public and call them names. His idea of negotiating with Democrats on Capitol is to tell them what to do, and that he doesn't have the kind of personal relationships, and that showing up at the congressional baseball game in midweek and bringing some beer and then going to the Hill, to try and urge Nancy Pelosi to lean on her members is far too little, too late. Mm-hmm. That's one view of it. My own view is that the Democrats have changed in the 20 years since Bill Clinton was getting NAFTA through. And, you know, we talk a lot in journalism and in politics about how the Republican Party has moved to the right. I was at lunch today, and I overheard a gentleman telling his mates at lunch in Washington, it's the kind of discussion you hear in Washington, you know, Ronald Reagan couldn't be nominated today by the Republicans.
Mm-hmm. And because he'd be too close to the center or...
Well, too liberal. I mean, yeah. Come on. And now, look, you and I know, I mean, President Obama said the same thing. That's silly. I mean, guys like Roosevelt and Reagan, they come along once every 100 years, and their parties do nominate them. But the point he's making is right. Sarah Palin's position on abortion, on immigration, for instance, I mean, she has nothing to do with Ronald Reagan's. Reagan signed the Immigration Control Act of 1986. It legalized 3 million people, most of them Mexican Americans, and he thought it was one of the best things he ever did. So, you know, the point's well taken. But what this thing on trade shows, what happened to President Obama, is that the Democrats have sort of quietly moved left at the same time. And President Clinton had trouble getting that NAFTA through. but he did it. And he called, and it was one of an extraordinary example of presidential leadership. He asked Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford and George H.W. Bush to make calls for him, and they did. He asked some of the old Reaganites to do it, and they did. And there was this fight in the Democratic caucus, but they got about 100 votes for it among the Democrats, minority of the votes, but it was what they needed.
Right.
I don't think the Democratic Party is where they were in 1992 on trade and social issues. I think it's gotten more liberal. So it's, I think my point is, I think the president has little less room to maneuver than people realize.
Mm-hmm. So what message were those Democrats, and there were a lot of them, that went against the president on this? And as you said, he really put himself out there saying, this is key, I need this. And they said, no, I don't think so. Not going to happen, at least not in this form. What message, is there a clear message that the Democrats were sending to the president?
Well, I hope not. And the reason I say that is because their public comments were kind of strange, like, go play with your Republican friends. And some of the liberals were saying that if the Republicans are willing to vote for this, it can't be good by definition. Well, if you think about the implications of that, it doesn't bode well for future compromises in this town on anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because Barack Obama has been the most overtly liberal president this country's ever had on a host of issues. He's a free trader, though, and the Democrats are listening. The Congressional Black Caucus, some of the Hispanic caucus, they were leery of this because they're leery of manufacturing jobs leaving. Some of them are sort of Elizabeth Warren Democrats, which is to say anything the Chamber of Commerce and these corporations want, they think it's a giveaway to big business and will come at the expense of American jobs. And the president was not able to convince them that this will actually create jobs, which is what, most economists believe. But he couldn't make that sale.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really so much say, this is important to me. He told them, this is important for the country. This will help the country. And they did not believe him.
Mm-hmm. So the Fast Track Authority most pressingly was needed to negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Understandably, countries, the other, I believe, 10 countries that would be involved in this partnership were looking to see what would happen with Congress because they don't want to accept conditions or negotiate points of this agreement with the Obama administration that then Congress could change in the ratification.
That's right. But, there's tweaks during ratification. There was for NAFTA. But they're looking at this. If you're a foreign, if you're a foreign leader, you're thinking, gee, Barack Obama doesn't have as much juice as I thought he did. The president remains popular, immensely popular, overseas among rank-and-file sort of voters in Western democracies and Eastern ones, too. But if you're looking at that, you're thinking, boy, he couldn't deliver. I don't know what's going to happen to this treaty if Congress starts fooling around with it, and they don't trust this president to do it. So, yes, it was unsettling to them, and I think the president realizes that. He's saying they're going to get another vote, and I think there'll be there's something else coming on this, but I don't know what.
Hmm. Beyond the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this denial of the fast-track authority for President Obama, does that have an impact on other maybe less high-profile agreements, but other agreements that are in the pipeline?
I don't know. That's a good question. And I was reading the Financial Times today and the Wall Street Journal, and I'll be honest, Judith, I just don't know that. It doesn't help the president in Washington, however, to be seen of as ineffectual. And by ineffectual, it means you can't deliver your own side. I mean, nobody can deliver the other side anymore. But the Democrats were so willing to buck him so publicly, I think there's some worry at the White House about what the last 2 years are going to be like.
Mm-hmm. We are talking today on All Things Political with Carl Cannon. He is Washington Bureau Chief for Real Clear Politics. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back tomorrow. You can join in at 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. You can also leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Kathleen Dunn Show. Have you been following the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations? Are you surprised and at all concerned that Democrats in Congress as well as labor unions went up against President Obama? Are you surprised that he and the Republicans actually had something to agree on but then couldn't deliver the votes? We'd appreciate you joining the conversation. Well, Carl, it's no surprise that this has been a period where unions have really been pummeled from all sides, and people that were both supporting the fast track and against the fast track were kind of in awe and amazement that that the unions were able to pull out such a clear victory on this. How did they succeed on the fast track in ways that they haven't been able to on other topics?
Well, the unions have a lot of they've been doing pretty well within the Democratic Party. Now, when we talk about unions, we're usually in politics within the Democratic Party. We're usually talking about public employee unions, the teachers union, firefighters, police. Teachers are the big one, but all these public unions. But this was an example of where, you know, the private industry unions haven't gone away. The FLCIO is still around. It is still potent. And I think this was an example. This was a chance for them to flex their muscles. They do not want to cripple the president, though. And these unions, the union leadership is heavily Democratic. So I don't know that this is the last word on the subject. But they want to be at the table on all of these agreements. They do not want the Chamber of Commerce or economists or good government people or moderates like myself coming in and saying free trade's good, blah, blah, blah. No, they want to know the deals. They want to know how many jobs it's going to cost. Are there going to be terms of employment overseas that American companies would have to abide by? Can they get out? Can they just take jobs away and use, you know, scab labor, underage labor? What about environmental standards? They're saying that if we're going to be a global player, then the rest of the world should follow some of the rules we follow, which are not capricious, but are designed to protect workers and protect the environment.
One of the concerns that I saw raised that it was really a calculated gamble that the big unions decided to withhold some of their usual campaign contributions until after the vote on fast track, both to encourage those who might be on the fence to vote their way, but also to encourage those who were already on board with the veto to talk to their colleagues. Was that a big risk, or do you think it was? I mean, it seems to have worked well for them, but was that a pretty big risk to take?
Judith, I've heard some of this talk, but I think some of it's overblown. You know, people, when there's a victory or a loss in Washington, people try to, you know, say that they pulled the strings. You know, every Washington memoir, the unofficial subtitle is really, if they had only listened to me. You know. In this case, it's a little early for primary challenges. Most of these Democrats, if you look for at these Democrats who voted against fast track, they don't need to be threatened. I mean, that's where they are. They're liberal people in liberal districts. These members were voting their conscience. You know, the Congressional Black Caucus, they've done a lot to protect the president. They've defended him. They've lashed out at his critics. But they didn't even support him. I can't think that, and most of those districts are very safe. Most incumbents are very popular. I don't think they're afraid of primary challenges. I don't think they're afraid of the unions. I think they're in sync with the unions.
And does this union victory right now mean anything special in the run-up to the presidential election? Do you think they will be able to yield more clout? Do they have a more effective strategy? What does it mean?
Well, it's already manifested itself. If you saw Hillary Clinton's speech yesterday, or some of her previous comments about this, she has not come out, as you might expect, by her past votes, by her husband's record, by her own state public statement. She has not come out in defense of the president's position. Mm-hmm. So, already, yes, the Democratic Party. I mean, Hillary Clinton reflects the establishment of the Democratic Party, that, you know, and the other great power center other than Barack Obama's White House is the Clintons. Mm-hmm. And she's not talking the way Bill Clinton talked in 1994. She's talking the way, you know, Rich Trump is in 2015. So already, yes, already this has happened. Elizabeth Warren is apparently not running for president, but if Hillary Clinton's not going to support free trade, she doesn't need to run for president. She's already influenced the debate. So, yes, I think so.
We are talking with Carl Cannon. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for Real Clear Politics. It's All Things Political. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn. We are going to take some calls on the issue of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and fast-track legislation. We're also going to talk about Hillary Clinton's more public, more high-profile campaign launch this weekend. Also, Jeb Bush's anticipated announcement today, and many more topics. What stood out to you in political news of the past week? We'd love to have you join in. You can call 800-486-8655. You can also leave a question or comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at Kay Dunn Show. Back in just a minute. Right now, it's All Things Political. Our guest is Carl Cannon, Washington Bureau Chief for Real Clear Politics. And Carl, let's go to the phones and Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Judith. And
hi.
And good afternoon to your guest, who your guest said earlier that he was basically for free trade deals. Well, I'm going to give you a good example of why this is, I hope, is completely shot down. If the president could have demonstrated to the nation, especially the unions and workers across the country, union and non-union workers, that NAFTA was a net plus for jobs in America, he easily could have got this through, but he couldn't hold that up as an example because NAFTA lost millions of jobs in America. I mean, you name the industry, we've lost jobs in it. So, and fast-tracking of any bill, we in Wisconsin have a bad taste in our mouth from what Scott Walker and the Republicans fast-tracked through the Wisconsin legislature. And it's just really sad that in a democratic country, we would allow anything to be fast-tracked because there should always be public input and there should be serious debate on every single bill. And I'd like to hear your guests' comments on that.
All right. Thanks for that comment, Ray. And Carl, what would you say to Ray's comment?
Actually, he makes several points. They're all fascinating to me. The first is I didn't mean to suggest that I favored this fast-track deal. I meant when I said we favor free trade, I meant that generically, sort of where the press is. I don't take a position on deals like this. I'm a reporter, but I see why he thought that. But I don't know how I would have voted if I were in Congress, and anybody who would elect me to Congress shouldn't be allowed to vote anyway. But let me just point out to let me say that I agree with that point he made, his central point about NAFTA, which is that if the president had been able to convince Democrats that NAFTA was a net jobs creator in the United States, these Democrats would have voted for it. And he was not able to do that. Now, I don't. There have been books written about NAFTA. There have been, economists have written PhDs on whether mm-hmm. it was a plus or minus, and whether lower consumer prices ought to be factored into that, and where else those jobs would have gone. It's complicated, but his point is right. The president didn't make that sale. In terms of his point about fast track, I don't think that. Well, I don't think that that's quite right. You're going to delegate authority to people. You can't have a plebiscite on every single issue. And the commander chief, we gave him great leeway on foreign policy and whatever your experience in Wisconsin with Scott Walker. And if you found it unpleasant, I understand. But this is different than that. This wasn't really a problem. These Democrats didn't have a problem with giving President Obama the authority. Some of the Republicans did. They had a problem with this deal. And, the Democrats are split. There's, the ardent free traders in the Democratic Party. Lawrence Summers, the former Treasury Secretary and former Harvard President and former Clinton administration person, is maybe the most forceful free trader left in that country. And he wrote, the Senate's rejection of President Woodrow Wilson's commitment of the United States was the greatest setback to U.S. global leadership of the last century. Then he says this would be the next one, that this is a terrible thing, that it would neuter, this is Lawrence Summers' phrase, neuter the U.S. presidency for the next 19 months. It would reinforce global concerns that the vicissitudes of domestic politics are increasingly rendering the United States a less reliable ally. Now, that's no Democrat wanted that said about Obama. These Democrats who voted against him did so in spite of the fact that they thought it would hurt him. They really don't believe in this Pacific Partnership. They don't want it, not in its current form.
All right. Thanks for that call, Ray. Let's go next to Marshall in Madison. Hi, Marshall.
I've been following this from more of the progressive side, and one of the bigger arguments that I've seen is that this trade deal is secret. Nobody can have access to the full text of it. And I was kind of wondering, our caller today says that economists say that it will add jobs and stuff to the economy. Well, how do we know that if we don't have the text of the agreement publicly available? And I'm kind of wondering, was NAFTA also held secretly like this, or were people able to look at the text and kind of figure out what it meant for them?
That's a good point, Marshall. Carl?
I don't know that anybody doesn't know what's in this. Some of the fine details that you can't access yet because they haven't been negotiated yet. In terms of NAFTA, that thing was very public and very publicly debated. And there were people, you know, this caller and Ray, the previous caller, sort of look at NAFTA, I'm inferring, as a jobs loser. But there were other considerations at the time about Mexico. Now, I'm old enough, I've been covering Washington a long time, to remember when one of the points of our immigration, this country's approaches to immigration in the 1980s and 1990s was, you know, to make the border less soluble, so it's not easy to get through, to punish employers, sanctions on employers, but also to bolster Mexico's economy. This was a stated national goal of the United States, of both parties, to help prop up Mexico's economy. This was not seen then, certainly not by progressives, as a negative thing, but a positive thing. Conservatives liked it. Liberals liked it. They're our neighbor. It was considered a foreign policy thing, a strong thing to do. And you just don't hear that kind of talk anymore, Judith. Like if jobs are created in Mexico, that's like they're stolen from the United States. And, you know, if you lose a job in Milwaukee and it goes to Mexico, yeah, you'd feel that way. But in Washington, the idea was that this was part of a whole. And this is what's being, I'm not hearing on this discussion here, is some of the geopolitical concerns. Now, you know, what Larry Summers wrote again was that, you know, the Chinese are active. We need to be active in the region. And crippling our president at this time when China's on the move is not a good geopolitical move. Now, that's the other part of the debate, that you're not hearing in some of these economic discussions that's part of President Obama's consideration.
In just a minute, we're going to move on to talking about Hillary Clinton's more high-profile campaign launch this weekend, also Jeb Bush's anticipated announcement of his candidacy today. You can join in at 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. You can also leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, or tweet us at KDunnShow. And let's take one more call on this topic, and then we'll move on, Carl. We have Tony in Milwaukee up next. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
My concern about this is that 600 corporations had input into this thing. It's secret. Not even Robert Reich, a former Secretary of Labor, had access to the whole agreement or the outline of the agreement. And who knows which countries are going to cheat? China's been known to cheat on almost every issue when it comes to trade with us. But yet, we're going to give them free rein on our trade? I mean, we've moved enough jobs to China, and we're tired of it out here. We're looking for jobs, and all we're ending up with jobs that are minimum wage or a little bit better. And everything's been shipped overseas and cut the costs for the corporations.
All right, thanks for that comment, Tony. Let's let Carl Cannon respond to that.
Well, Judith, all I'll say to that is that's the argument being made, and it's being made by progressives, and it's being made by working class, you know, Reagan Democrats. It's being made by working class people in this country of all stripes, and by certain academic liberals. He mentioned Robert Reich, who was in the Clinton cabinet, and that is the argument. It ships jobs overseas. It favors corporations, and it enters a deal with trading partners who can't really be trusted to keep up their end of the bargain. Those are the arguments against it. I can't improve on it.
Well, thanks, Tony, for that call. And Tony was really making the point that, you know, Congress and the president are out of touch with everyday Americans. Now, certainly that's going to be a goal of all of the many declared and probably soon to be declared candidates for president in the next several months. Even though Hillary Clinton's campaign, you know, she's been in the race for a couple months, she really brought it up to a new level of high profile this weekend. Her announcement in April was a simple, short video, but Saturday she laid out some really tangible points for her campaign. What stood out to you, Carl?
Well, first of all, let's start with this. Her campaign told the New York Times this is going to be a major policy speech. Well, it wasn't. I mean, campaign stump speeches are rarely major addresses, but it was an interesting one. And what stood out to me was on a series of issues, LGBT issues, global climate change, immigration, even what we've been talking about, trade, she staked out a position that was more liberal, that was to the left of wherever Bill Clinton had been in his 8 years in the White House, where she had been as First Lady, mostly to the left of where she was in the Senate. And she served notice that she announces that she intends to run a progressive campaign for president. And she thinks, she said the Republicans were the party of yesterday and that she's the party of tomorrow. And it was a good sort of hint as to where this thing's going.
Well, and I think it's really interesting because although Hillary Clinton seems to be the front runner in the latest polls, Bernie Sanders also seems to be surging. In fact, in the straw poll at the recent Wisconsin Democratic Party convention, Bernie Sanders came in a very close second to Hillary Clinton, and she got less than half of the total votes of the delegates that were there. Is her coming out in a slightly more progressive left bent partly due to Bernie Sanders being in the race, to Elizabeth Warren not being in the race, but certainly, you know, pushing the agenda from where she sits in the Senate?
Well, I think so. I'd say yes to both of those factors. But look, Bernie Sanders isn't really running for president either, not in any conventional way. He's not going to run attack ads on Hillary Clinton. He's not even going to criticize her, not really. He's running, he says to, you know, look, everybody who runs for president, ego's a big part of it, so let's just stipulate to that. He's running because he's been in the Senate, and he's kind of a backbencher, and he wants to have his voice heard. But the other thing is he wants to shape the conversation in the Democratic Party. I would say that he's already done this, and Elizabeth Warren, without even running, has done it. But also, the Clintons are smart. Hillary Clinton can read a poll. She knows where the Democratic Party is. She'd have been doing a lot of this anyway. You know, on issue after issue, she's more progressive now than she was in the White House. Bill Clinton ran as a new Democrat at a time when Democrats were considered, you know, so liberal and out of touch, just, you know, professors and left-wingers and, you know, a few pockets of people still liked him. And Clinton said he ran for office, Bill did, in 1992, promised to be a new kind of Democrat. Part of that Democrat was pro-free trade, pro-NAFTA. That's the new Democrat who embarrassed Jesse Jackson at a Democratic Party meeting by criticizing an obscure rap singer named Sister Souljah. Bill Clinton made her unobscure for a while, and who rejected gay marriage out of hand. So this is not the Democratic Party that Hillary Clinton is running in anymore. And she's not going to be a new kind of Democrat like Bill Clinton. Well, she's going to be a new kind of Democrat like Barack Obama, even newer than Barack Obama. So, long-winded answer, yes. Bernie Sanders has made a difference, but the voters are speaking. These calls we're getting, mm-hmm. This is where the Democratic Party is now. It's a mm-hmm. progressive party. You have people now self-identifying liberal in this country higher than ever in history. And that's not a trivial thing. Those Gallup numbers have been the same for two generations. They're ticking up, and they're ticking up for a number of reasons, demographic changes mostly in this country. But look, Hillary Clinton knows what's going on in her party.
And just for the record, I do think that Bernie Sanders has said that he's not in the race just to shape the discussion, that he is in it to win. We certainly can't read his mind, but his words say that he's in it to win. So,
well, I was giving you my view. I don't think he really thinks he's going to be the nominee. I don't think he really even necessarily wants to be the nominee. Mm-hmm. But having said that, Judith, and your point is well taken. Once you're doing it, you're going to all these, you're eating all these chicken dinners, you're shaking all these hands, you're listening to thousands
kissing
of
all those
people.
Babies.
Well, yes. And people you never met coming up to you and say, God bless you, sir. You are, this country needs you. You know, at some point you do begin to think, well, okay, that Oval Office, you start to imagine the painting you'd bring in there, sure.
We are talking with Carl Cannon. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for Real Clear Politics, talking about the political news of the last week. You can join in at 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. That's The Kathleen Dunn Show, or tweet us at KDunnShow. Now, we were talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership earlier. We're talking about Hillary Clinton getting nudged to the left. Bernie Sanders has been critical of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, joining Elizabeth Warren and other Democrats in delivering that blow to President Barack Obama on Friday on the fast-track legislation. Sanders has also been pushing Clinton to take a stand on the TPP. Has she, and what can we expect from her on this topic?
Well, she's dodged it, mostly. And she's dodged it because she doesn't. She's in a tough position. She's given lip service lately to the critics of it. She hasn't really supported it, but this is an issue where she has to be. What's she going to be, disloyal to Barack Obama, who she served in? She's in his administration, and mm-hmm. She's going to break with him on this issue, break with him publicly. That this is not probably the issue it's going to be with. She's going to be disloyal to Bill Clinton, who she's still married to. Look, she's got a tough spot on this, and we tend to be very critical of politicians in Washington, and I guess elsewhere, other mm-hmm. state capitals, but we forget they're human beings. Jeb Bush, who announces today, was just pilloried a few weeks ago for not basically denying his brother, the way Simon Peter denied Christ. Well, guess what? It's his brother. If you're going to give... Sometimes you have to give these people a little bit of a break. She's going to figure out where she is on this issue. And where she is on this issue is she doesn't want to support it, but she doesn't want to act disloyal to the president or her husband. I kind of find that refreshing and almost, human.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Jake in Oshkosh is up next. Hi, Jake.
Hi. I've been listening to your program.
Yes.
And I want to ask the guest, does the guest believe that the Democratic Party actually thinks that Hillary Clinton has become a progressive? Because they've been led down this promised land before, this progressive promised land before, with Barack Obama and his 2008 campaign, and they've been totally let down. So is he telling me that Hillary Clinton is now a progressive?
All right, that's a good question. Jake, Carl Cannon, how would you answer that?
I can answer Jake from Oshkosh very succinctly. I don't know whether Hillary Clinton thinks that progressives think she's a progressive, and I don't know what I don't know if progressives are going to accept that. I know that what Hillary Clinton wants to do is run the way successful nominees do, as a person who represents her party, and it's hard to represent. We have two parties in this country. We have 300 million people, and we have two major political parties. So that's difficult to do. She's the party of Larry Summers. She wants to be the party of Larry Summers, who said that not endorsing the Trans-Pacific, not endorsing this treaty, would cripple the president for 19 months and would be the worst public policy mistake you could do to a president since Woodrow Wilson. Okay, she wants to represent Larry Summers, and she wants to represent Jake from Oshkosh. So that's a lot of ground to cover. It's going to be hard to do, but what she wants people to think is that she is a good liberal Democrat, and her word is evolving. She used that in the context of gay marriage. She hasn't used that in the context of trade or economic issues, but she wants people to think that. And she wants people to think that, Jake. Not a question of what I think, but she wants people to think she's moved to the left with her party.
Thanks, Jake, for that call. This is All Things Political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, who will be back tomorrow. We are talking with Carl Cannon, Washington Bureau Chief for Real Clear Politics. We're going to come back with a chat about Jeb Bush's announcement of his candidacy and much more. You can join in by calling 1-800-486-8655. Right now, it is All Things Political. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and we were talking with Carl Cannon, Washington Bureau Chief for Real Clear Politics. Well, Jeb Bush is expected to announce his candidacy coming later today. What is the timing that Jeb Bush is announcing now? It seems like it's been expected for a long time. Is there a reason, Carl Cannon, why this is the right time?
Well, Jeb, that's actually very interesting. Jeb had hoped by now to scare people out of the race. That almost sounds like a punchline.
I can just hear Dr. Phil saying, and how's that working for you?
Yeah, exactly. And so what you have is the largest presidential field in, ever, as far as I know, mm-hmm. certainly since I've been 10 announced candidates after Jeb comes with some of the big ones. I won't mention a certain governor that you're familiar with.
We'll ask you about him in just a bit.
Yet to come. And, he'd hope by now that he'd sort of scared the people out of the race. The only person who he's sort of done that to seems to be maybe Chris Christie. Hmm. So, look, that didn't work.
But certainly that wasn't the only issue that was keeping Chris Christie out.
Sure. But Jeb went and raised money in Christie's backyard and sort of showed that he, not Christie, was maybe the great hope of the establishment, the Eastern establishment. So, yeah, Christie has other issues, and he may still run. But it hasn't worked with anybody else. And, in fact, it didn't even work with Marco Rubio, who was a Jeb Bush protege in Florida. So it hasn't worked. So he might as well announce now. It's not getting any better out there for him, you know. And now he's considered in the top tier. He's not when he announces today that the polls show and the pundits show, he and Scott Walker and Marco Rubio are probably the three top tier as of now. Doesn't mean a lot at this stage. We can talk about Jimmy Carter in 1975 mm-hmm. if you want. You can win a bar bet, Judith. What was Jimmy Carter's poll numbers right now in 1975?
I don't know.
1%.
So there you go.
Yeah, 1%.
Never say never, right?
That's right. And he went on to be the nominee and, in fact, the president. So,
I think the interesting thing...
Mike Huckabee, take heart, you know?
Yeah. What I find interesting is that, Jeb Bush was the anticipated, when is he going to get in, but at this point, as you said, with such a really crowded field, what is Jeb Bush bringing to the table, to the discussion that, that makes him different other than having the name recognition?
Oh, well, look, that's a two-part question, Judith, whether you meant it that way or not. He is a Bushy. He's a Bush, and that brings him tremendous advantages in fundraising ability and familiarity. There's people who know him in all these party apparatuses all throughout the country. It's also a disadvantage. There was George W. Bush is more popular now than he left office. He gets more popular every day. That's the nature of these things. But when he left office, there was clear Bush fatigue in this country. And David Vondrelli, the great political writer from Time, who I recommend you have on your show, he lives in the heartland in Kansas City. David says, if this guy's name with his record was Jeb Ellis, we wouldn't be having this conversation, but it's Jeb Ellis Bush. We'd be saying, well, the Republicans have somebody that can beat Hillary Clinton, and it's this guy, this former governor from Florida. He's good. Well, but it's Jeb Ellis Bush, and so we're saying, do we want another Bush-Clinton race? Mm-hmm. And he takes Hillary off the hook among Republicans for being a legacy candidate. He brings back memories of a presidency people not all Americans want to remember, and it's baggage as well as an advantage.
Mm-hmm. He does court Latinos unlike really any other Republican. He announced in Miami. That's significant. He's not only speaks Spanish, but he's proudly raising and has raised children that are bilingual and bicultural. He married a Mexican immigrant. Does that give him some really much-needed footing in the Latino community?
Well, I think it does, and it's not just you and I who think it might. I interviewed a person who... It was off the record, so I'm sorry I can't repeat his name, but he's a well-known Hispanic activist in the Democratic Party. He does polling and raises money, and he consults, and he'd just come out of the White House where he'd been advising the Obama people on immigration issues. And he said to me, if Hillary, next year, he said, I'll probably end up working for Hillary Clinton, but I might vote for Jeb Bush. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, look, man, Jeb Bush would be the first Hispanic president. He is. He gets us. He's one of us. He is Latino in every way but except, you know, his racial, his ethnic, his own personal ethnic makeup. And he says, we're moving way beyond that as a country. He gets us. He live. He's lived the life. He's one of us. It was a very proud, really profound testimonial. I was moved by a guy who's a Democratic Party activist, and, you know, and will end up working for Hillary Clinton, and will probably forget we had that conversation, you know, because he wants Democrats to win. But I think that does help Bush, and I think the party really needs it. The Republican Party, I mean, this idea that I hate to pick on the poor guy because he lost and he's, you know, he's never hurt, done anything to me. But when Mitt Romney said the answer to immigration was self-deportation, he said that in a debate I was covering, and I sent a text to my White House correspondent. I said, well, Mitt Romney just conceded the general election. I mean, that's just a kind of witless, bigoted thing to say. Makes no sense as public policy. Well, Jeb Bush doesn't talk like that, and neither does Rubio. Marco Rubio is very evocative on that this is an country of immigrants. He still talks that way. And those two candidates in the Republican Party seem to me to be able to position their party, well, they'd try, in a way that wouldn't cost you, you know, millions of Hispanic votes. Not the others, not so much.
So the Republican Party of Iowa, the leadership there Friday morning, voted unanimously to cancel the 2015 Iowa straw poll, which was set to take place in August. Is this a sign of how campaigns and outreach to the voting population are changing?
Well, it's sure. It's also a testament to how bad the Iowa straw poll was for Republicans. I mean, you know, when people like Rand Paul and Michelle Bachmann, these people win your, not Rand Paul, Ron Paul, when they're the, you know, the forces in your straw poll, you guys, okay, what are we really measuring here? Well, you're measuring a level of intensity among a very small minority of people. You know, Vox, the website VOX, Vox had an interesting piece, I think it was today, on, shoot, why don't they just cancel the Iowa caucuses while they're at it? You know, I mean, this Iowa straw poll was exceedingly misrepresentative and misleading of even where the Republican Party is. The Republican Party is more conservative than it's ever been. The Republican Party of Iowa is one of the most conservative parties. And in the straw vote, you get the most sort of activist conservative people. So it skews the thing. But this writer in Vox argues that the Iowa caucus itself has that problem. And he's not the first. This is something we talk about every 4 years. 4 years ago, 120,000 people participated in the Iowa caucuses among the Republican Party. That's 20% of the registered Republicans in that state and 5% of the voting age public. And so when Rick Santorum edges out Mitt Romney, that doesn't tell you Rick Santorum's a strong candidate. It might tell you Romney's weak, but it tells you where the base is. And, you know, Mike Huckabee carried it 4 years before that. So I don't think Iowa is very representative. And that Iowa straw poll made things worse for the Republicans in Iowa, not better.
And we did mention Governor Scott Walker a little earlier, but, you know, with Jeb Bush's announcement coming later today that he is officially running for president, that makes Scott Walker one of the last, if not the last, candidate expected to announce on the Republican side. Governor Walker said he's waiting to sign the Wisconsin budget before declaring, but could there be other motivations there?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I would be a schmuck if I came on public radio and started telling you inside stuff about Scott Walker. You and most, and judging by the callers, most of your listeners know more about Scott Walker than I do. But he's waiting. There's no reason. People know he's running. He's not really waiting to do anything. So, you know, he's already raising the money. He's putting the apparatus together. To me, he's already running. These guys, you know, in the old days, when I first started covering presidential politics, a person would announce, they would announce that they were forming an exploratory committee. And then they would announce that the exploratory committee, surprise of surprises, had recommended that they run. And then they would announce that they were going to have an announcement, and then they would announce for president. They had three or four of these things. And Hillary Clinton's done that, and I think Scott Walker will do some of that. It's just a way to attract more attention. And maybe going last, you know, you wait and you get you're freshest in the minds of the people. There may be tactical considerations, but I don't think it much matters. Everybody thinks he's running already.
But isn't there a concern, too, of some level of fatigue? As we said, when Jeb Bush announces today, he's number 10 on the Republican side. You know, is there a risk of waiting too long and having people kind of already tired of hearing about new candidates?
Well, sure. I think there is a risk, and especially if a guy announces and everybody says, oh, wait a minute, what's the news? You were already running. I already thought you were running. What do you mean?
Which is kind of, I think, a little what's happening with Jeb Bush.
I think it is what's happening.
I bet there are people saying, wait, he didn't announce already? You know.
Well, it certainly happened with Hillary Clinton. So he shields a speech over the weekend, and she announces, wait a minute, people say, you announced a month ago.
Yeah.
And Walker's case is even worse. You know, at some point, you look cynical if you wait too long. But he may not even be the last. What if Christie gets in? What if John Kasich gets in? I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. Why stop at 10 or 11? Why not have 20?
Why
I don't.
Not?
Yeah. And And that, you know, it presents all kinds of interesting challenges. How many debates? They're already arguing over the rules. If you have 18 people on a stage in an hour-long debate, I mean, you do the math. Mm-hmm. You know, each get a couple of minutes.
Right.
And sum up why you want to be president. We have 8 seconds for each of you. Mm-hmm. You know, it begins to be ridiculous. Mm-hmm. If you're a Republican, and, you know, it doesn't sound like many of your listeners are, but I'll bet some are. If you're a Republican, the good news, if there is good news in this huge field, is that these dudes do not seem to be afraid of Hillary Clinton. So maybe that's the good news.
Mm-hmm. And when you say dudes, it's not just dudes.
Well, you're speaking of my California compadre, Carly
right.
Fiorina.
Carly Fiorina.
Yeah, I'm doing an event in Denver with her, and I'm moderating a discussion with Carly Fiorina, and she's a former Hewlett Packard chief executive and accomplished person in business. She that can be a mixed blessing, as Mitt Romney learned. But she ran for the Senate against Barbara Boxer and lost. But she's a person who's been very forceful on the campaign stump about Hillary Clinton, very accessible to the press, and she's actually gotten good reviews everywhere she's been. She's who I had in mind, by the way, when I said that Jimmy Carter was at 1% in the polls in 1975, because that's about where she is, not much higher, but, you know, she makes a good impression. She's going to be in these debates. These Republicans can't possibly want a stage with all these guys and this credible woman, you know, excluded because of some arbitrary number. So you'll see her up there, and I think she'll acquit herself well in the debates.
We have a caller that I want to make sure we get to. Rich in Rhinelander is on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I just wanted to say that we're kind of at a watershed moment in the country in terms of economic anxiety and also a response to war. I mean, we're kind of coalescing as a Eugene McCarthy moment and a Ross Perot moment. And I wanted to go on record that I felt your guest, as much as I respect him, sounded very condescending towards Bernie Sanders' candidate. I think the one thing about Bernie Sanders is voters really do understand that this guy means what he says, and this has been his long-term message. I don't think people feel that way about Hillary Clinton.
Thanks for that call, Rich. Carl?
Yeah, that's, you know what, Judith, that's probably a fair criticism, and I'll just accept it. I was condescending towards Sanders, and I probably need to rethink that. I don't think he has not indicated to me he's serious about running for president. If I'm mistaken in that, I'll stand corrected, but I think he needs to do some things. Your callers have not been shy about criticizing Hillary Clinton, but Bernie Sanders has yet to do that. And so I don't think, when I say I don't, you know, you could argue that he's a stalking horse for Hillary Clinton, that he's a real challenger from the left who would take her on directly. I'm thinking of Bill de Blasio now, that there's no room for that person. So I am skeptical that Sanders is really running.
Well, and let's not forget Martin O'Malley, too.
Yes, well, Martin O'Malley. That's right. And he's sort of in his way. I'm skeptical of that, but I'm certainly open to having my mind changed. But Sanders has to change it.
And Carl Cannon, I want to remind you of one thing you said. You're sure that some of our listeners are conservative, as I recall when you were on with me about 4 months ago. You said the same thing, and immediately we had a couple callers call in to assure you that there are conservatives listening.
Yeah, one called, actually. It was a very nice caller. I'm waiting for that caller today. But real clear, you know, we're very bipartisan, nonpartisan. We represent all sides, but look, all the callers have called today have been thoughtful, though. I have no complaints about them.
Well, we are very glad that you joined us today for All Things Political, Carl. It was a real pleasure.
Judith, you know so much about politics. I'll talk about things with you anytime.
Well, it's a date. We'll make sure that it happens again. Carl Cannon, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right.
Carl Cannon is the Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics. He's a past recipient of two of the most prestigious awards for White House coverage. Prior to his time at Real Clear Politics, he held positions including Executive Editor of PoliticsDaily.com, D.C. Bureau Chief for Reader's Digest, and White House Correspondent for the Baltimore Sun and National Journal. Well, it was a real pleasure to have him on with us, and I hope that you will stay tuned. Coming up next hour, we're going to talk about research on cognitive aging and how we can keep our brains active, flexible, and healthy as long as possible. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn. She will be back tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.